Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 3rd, 2006, and today's forum is entitled The Palestinian Question, Is There Any Hope? Moderated by Paul Olson, number FO2006-09. Let's listen in.
Staff coordinator, and I get to kick these things off, but it's your show. Another word for this, or another way to look at it for you, perhaps, is that besides a forum, it's a town meeting, where you get to share your ideas and ask your questions. We have a couple of men here we're going to introduce and introduce themselves and just kick it off with some of their look at their perspective. But the night is yours. I'll tell you the rules of a forum that we try to follow is we want as many people to speak as possible, and I will just kind of watch through there. And if some people want to speak and haven't had a chance yet, we will go to those people before we go to somebody the second time. The other thing is that we'll stop at 9:45. And time at Holden, I think, everywhere, but here especially, it matters that we stick to that to honor you people who have lots of things to do. But also, and this is just as important, to encourage you to carry on conversation outside of this venue. And that enlarges the whole context, and that's a healthy thing, too. So for those two reasons, at 9:45, we'll stop. And we'll start with our two gentlemen who are just going to give us an opening perspective, and we'll let it roll. So, Norm or Jonathan, either one.
Just sit or stand for the camera.
The word. No camera.
Yeah, okay, so this one isn't.
It's recorded.
Okay.
Yeah, this is recorded, so well, if you get mad, hang, be cool.
Norm Moline is my name. I teach at Augustana College, but and I'm a cultural geographer. And so, but also my brother was the Lutheran pastor at the Lutheran Church of the Redeemer in the old city of Jerusalem from 1971 to 1977. And so as a brother, I went to visit him a couple of times, and both with him and with some anthropologists and others in the Holy Land at the time, we managed to go all the way up to the hills of the Lebanon border and all the way down to what was then called Sharm el-Sheikh, down at the southern edge of the Sinai Peninsula, because that was still occupied. And so over those visits, plus my own geographic background, I followed the Middle East a lot. And one of the concerns, and I'm sure we'll get to it later when Jonathan was having his speech the other day when we talked about hope, when my brother was there and we visited, he really went over with very much kind of an open mind. But that was some of the conflicts occurred in 73 and elsewhere, and already after the 67 war, there he was living in the old city in the Arab quarter, and he would see one village after another, even then, being bulldozed, Palestinian, and seeing the settlements going in. And he, trained as a pastor, hadn't followed all the UN resolutions that we've heard about here, but he knew that that had happened, and just something is wrong. This is occupied. While they had the negotiations, just had all the settlements going on, and one after another, the Palestinian houses bulldozed in 73, 74, 75, and to be honest, by the time he left, he was just furious at how this could happen to a people. And so he left wondering, still, like we've all heard here, with wish for a lot of hope. And there were groups then, which he was excited about, despite the problems. There were Palestinians and Israelis sitting down and talking with each other. Despite what was going on in the big scene, how can we make this work? And there were these glimmers of hope. I get frustrated in the sense that it's now 30-some years later, and the same thing. I just tossed out, I was cleaning out some files this summer. My wife was talking to my son, our son, over the phone, and I came upon this article, and I swear, if I would have passed that over to her and have her read that, she could have said, hey, I just saw this article in the paper. Listen to this, Dave. And if she would have read that and then told him, this isn't 2006, this is 1977, he would have said, I don't believe you. You must have read it. That must have been yesterday's paper. It was incredible. The last two points, there are three points quickly from a final geographer point of view, is one of the things we learn in cultural geography, among them, is that almost every ethnic group, has an attachment to place. We call it topophilia, topo for place and philia, attachment to it. And that's true with even us. Most people have some kind of topophilia to a place. And that's certainly the case with ethnic groups. They like to have a sense of a territory which is theirs, and not just being a place where they are a minority in that place, but the place where they are the majority. This is their turf. When it comes to boundary making, we often talk about different kinds of boundaries as geographers, geometric ones that are drawn like Utah and Colorado, and then you look at the U.S. and it's like someone dropped a checkerboard down. Or you can have natural boundaries, or you can have ethnographic boundaries. And from a cultural geography point of view, you wish that every boundary would somehow be an ethnographic boundary, so that the political map would reflect the cultural map. And so I use this example of the Middle East conflict, where the boundaries were none of those, really. They superimposed boundaries with geometry lines, crazy things. And then we wonder why there are cultural conflicts when you're ending up splitting cultures. And so that's a perspective that I think is pretty serious here. And lastly, geographers, some of us are also concerned about the natural environment. And we know that the water resources of this region, the whole area is tied together as several big watersheds. But as we all know, water flows from one end to the other. Sometimes it goes underground, but the real way to manage water is to manage it according to the watershed, which in this case, the political boundaries go across it. And so it's a tough call when some of the leaders in our discipline have tried to work with hope with the people of the Middle East to somehow manage the water resources collectively. And sometimes it's worked and sometimes it hasn't. Those are some tough issues as I see them.
Great. Well, I feel like I've been talking a lot. I'll just say briefly maybe something that hasn't been said. As church people in this country, we are heirs to some, I think, visionaries from the period right after World War II, when humanity, or the part of humanity that we relate to at least, had been through its second World War in less than 30 years. And in the ashes of the war were created the international institutions that we still have, the UN principally, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, any number of things like that. But also some of the key foundations of international law, which have been going back quite a bit farther than that, but perhaps the most interesting one to think about is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. If you've never read it, go and read it. It's a bit sad to read it because it looks like pie in the sky, but you have to know that Christians and Jews and non-Muslim, mostly white men, mostly Protestants, the Christians involved, but we have to grant that they did some good work despite their lack of diversity. They had, as religious people, they were consulted by the power brokers of the post-war era, especially in the U.S., especially people like John Foster Dulles, who was a very committed church person, to generate a position on religion. And today, if you're not religious and you don't have confidence that religion will come through for humanity and for God, the thought of religion and politics interacting today is actually quite scary for much of the human race. The ones who don't see a way to get what they want by doing that, and who aren't maybe religious themselves. What these guys did in writing the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, in dialogue with secular authorities, was to say that in order to guarantee freedom of religion, religion had to, each religion, especially the dominant Judeo-Christian religion that we're part of, had to cede any claim to a special status in order to allow humanity to have true freedom of religion, reflecting, I think, a little bit the freedom of choice that God has given us. And what I want to just say as a starter here is we need to live in a world increasingly where the will of God is actually reflected in a sort of a rules-based system for dealing with trouble. Call it the rule of law. Call it affirmation of basic values. Things that don't favor anybody from the start. Things that are inclusive. Things that are universal. Those words, universal, inclusive, I think are godly words in secular clothing. And so where I work at the World Council of Churches, we take our range of Christian commitment of all stripes, You know, it's the most inclusive ecumenical organization in the world. It's everything but the Catholics, basically, in the Christian world. And we work closely with them. You know, they're too big to need us, but we like them and they like us. And I'm saying this because taking all of that, we put it in our back pocket and we say, what we need to promote in the world is the voice of faith arguing for the application of international law and the improvement of international law. And this is a strange thing to say in America, because how many of you ever think about international law? But there's a large body of it, and case law is being made all the time. And the fundamentals of it are especially oriented towards our most troublesome things: war, violence, conflict. So we affirm those as steps forward that provide a universal platform. And on that score, the conflict in Israel-Palestine is almost like a litmus test for what I said the other day. Do we want to live in a community that has some structure of governance, some common investment, some way of settling disputes through rules and arbitration and negotiation, rather than the alternative, which is violence, and has been throughout human history? And what you're saying, Norm, let me just add on to that. Up until when was it okay for people to go out and find some land and say it was theirs? And if they're really interested, say God gave it to them. Up until when was that possible without killing too many people? I don't know. I don't think it lasted very long. I think you had to pretty much start killing people once you started taking that route. But it's certainly no longer possible. And the Middle East, interestingly enough, is the place where civilizations and ethnicities are laid on top of each other like pancakes. And so the only way out is some kind of, unless you want violence, and who gets to be king of the hill for as long as they can have the biggest weapons? The only way out is this rule of law. And I think the erosion of those international institutions and the chronic lack of attention to international law by our government, we're the major citizen. We're the leading citizen on the planet, and we are, I think it's absolutely fair to say, the biggest outlaw. Mm-hmm. So how would you like to live in a community where the leading citizen was the biggest outlaw? And this feeling is growing by the day around the world. Mm-hmm. And the Palestinians are a place where we could prove that we believe in the rule of law, or we can prove that actually might makes right. And so there's a lot more at stake. As Christians, we could go much deeper into some of the religious issues. But I think I wanted to just give you an example of a man who was a professor at the Philadelphia Seminary of the whatever Lutheran church that was back then, LCA, I believe, Friedrich Nolde. Mm-hmm. Read his book. There's a book about him, not his book, but a book written by him. It's called For All People and All Nations. And it's the description of Friedrich Nolde's life and his participation and leadership in the Declaration of Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and this voluntary stepping down from the pinnacles of power that Christians could have taken because of the victory of America and Britain and some other Christian country in World War II. But, you know, the winners were basically Christians. We could have mixed that all up and said this was going to be a Christian world regime, but they didn't. And I think that's an important point for us.
Great, thank you. Okay, folks. Yes?
The question I have goes back to what you had said before, that most terrorism is rooted in people not having what they need. And I go back to 9/11, Osama bin Laden. What was the root there? What causes his need for retribution?
Well, as usual, I have an answer, but I think we really ought to look for some other people's answers. I mean, I'll be happy to jump in too, but I think we should leave.
One of the things that question suggests is that we're looking at the causes rather than the symptoms, and that's important.
Yeah.
Today's paper, by the way, Bin Laden said, the idea was hatched in me to destroy the Twin Towers when Israel invaded Lebanon the last time. It's in today's paper. So imagine what's going on right now.
So how is that related?
Well, so to talk about that, I mean, the Palestinian question ties into all terrorism, but you guys are...
I think just one anecdotal answer or response anyways, and I think it was February 2003 when President Bush talked about a crusade to clean things up in Iraq, not knowing that, that word would actually be understood with a long history, not just by Osama bin Laden, and not just by Muslims, but certainly by Muslims, and certainly by Muslims who still remember with acute memory the agony of Christian crusade. For them, it's not ancient history. I mean, it's not even history for George Bush. I don't think he meant it in that way, he just crusade. But to use it without thinking in that kind of way as a volatile word, I think not used in a malignant way, but certainly was heard that way. So you ask what fuels someone like Osama, I think there are many things, but memory is a big part of it. The memory of violence done to them.
One of the things in the geographic text about this comes up when you think just about the whole notion of globalization. The U.S. may have a balance of payments deficit in terms of trading commodities, but in terms of our lifestyle and whatever's happening here, permeating other countries, where it's going all over the place, and that includes some of the bad things as well. So all the stuff that comes out of Hollywood, the dominance by American multinationals, the firms that end up setting establishments over there, it's just so powerful around that they're not only Osama bin Laden, but a number of others think, hello, wait a minute, how do we even have control over our own culture now? And how do we prevent, how can they pick and choose with the new media? It's very hard to pick and choose what is allowed into a country. And therefore, some of the traits that even maybe some in this room might not like to see as American, suddenly it's showing up on the streets in the Middle East. Everything from clothing styles to, as I say, the movies coming out and everything else. And so one way to sort of take that on is to go for the symbol of that whole globalization of American materialism, so you go for the World Trade Center.
And then his culture is Saudi Arabia, isn't it?
Yeah.
Bin Laden. So we've got this close political connection with Saudi Arabia, the United States does, and so we're infiltrating them with so much of our culture that he doesn't have a chance, and you want to try to exclude the United States, but I guess you can get, you know, someone else can fill this in, wasn't able to keep the United States influence out, and I think he became sort of a black sheep. From their vantage point, too.
Bin Laden is a tribe name. There are many, many people in the Bin Laden tribe. And as you said, he's not one of the ones that is accepted with the main family in Saudi. I mean, that's something they have very much said in their own papers. But these are tribes. All of these families that are the leaders of these countries are tribes. They still think tribal. Some of these countries didn't even become having highways until 1974. They come into our world very, very fast. And that is scary, too, because what we give to them, to me, is not our best.
Why are we talking about Bin Laden? In fact, I thought we were talking about Palestinians.
Yeah, can we talk about something
else? Well, actually, let me just, this will tie in, and that is that Hanan Ashrari, you made the sovereign during the Oslo Accord, part of Oslo Accords during the Madrid talks. She was the woman who was the PLO spokesperson. And, you know, what she has shared was that the Palestinians basically heard Bin Laden link his, you know, effort, his mission, linking the Palestinians, it was news to the Palestinians just as much as it was to the Americans. This was not something, the Palestinians were not linked in on this. It wasn't their agenda. It wasn't their path. It is an injustice that is seen in that region. And Palestinians have felt very misused by Bin Laden in directing that kind of attention and linking Palestinians to terrorism in that way.
Which is exactly how it really is linked now, because the war on terror is an all-purpose excuse for any of our allies to squash their opponents. And since 9/11, Israel's dialogue, it's always been about terrorists. whether the term applies or not. If you're a Palestinian, you think of yourself as a freedom fighter. The Israelis call you a terrorist. You're fighting for your national rights. You're passionate for your national freedom, your human rights. You're called a terrorist. Now that war on terror is the leitmotif of world politics because of our response to 9/11, it's just a gift for them to finish it off with the Palestinians. So the link is after the fact. Bin Laden's opportunistic linking, whether he thought of it in Lebanon, you know, who knows? I wouldn't give him any credit for anything important, but except the expression of a sense that his part of the world is being invaded by the culture that Nora mentions, by our primary export, which is culture, as well as our business control, as well as our addiction to petroleum. And if that's your heritage and it's being sold away in a few decades for the decadent lifestyle of godless people who are living in a ridiculous way, as the whole world can see, that's got to be an extra twist to it. But I think there's a real sense of being occupied by a cultural intrusion, nowhere more dramatic than through satellite television. I've sat with devout Muslims and hit the remote. And I can't tell you what's on the satellites that hover over the Middle East. And it's all identified with the West.
Have you had that with Palestinians, though? I have not experienced that with Palestinians. Because they have Israeli TV right next door.
Israeli TV doesn't care what I'm talking about. I'm talking about pornography into every household in the Middle East that has a dish. 20 channels, 30 channels. It's in St. George's Hostel in Jerusalem. And the dishes are all over the Middle East. And this is, it's all, they first heard of it and saw it, and now it's being copied by other groups. Turkish pornography, Indian pornography,
Egyptian
pornography. And, you know, this is a place, I mean, look how they dress. Look what they think about indecency. I would say pornography alone could get you excited enough to knock down the two twin towers. I really do. I really believe that. Because it's so just totally unacceptable. And I think we should think the same way. I honestly do. I can't believe what's on TV. Why do we put up with it? See, we put up with it. We're accomplices in this. I really believe we are.
Well, part of it is that there's a fundamental belief that you can express yourself in, you know, most ways, and there are pornographic things that are considered to be obscenity that are not allowed as free speech, but you can express yourself in most ways, and then you pick and choose. And it seems that if the conservative Muslim view is, no, you control what comes in, and that any threat to control of what people experience and what they have access to, you know, is a threat to their way of life, then we really have a goal. I want to talk a little bit about if people see either forums in which people can talk to one another that have either been successful in the past through the international community, or they see as ways that people can talk. I mean, you know, I think many people don't feel that really the people in the Muslim world are capable, you know, many of us don't feel that the people in the Muslim world are capable of governing themselves. You know, what you know, in a way that is peaceable, that fits into the international community, that certainly is wrong. I mean, I can't imagine that that's correct. But they, you know, may be threatened by the pluralistic society that we have. They see that as being wrong. They see that as not being the way that they would want to live their lives. And how can they allow us to choose it for ourselves? I mean, are there some ways that these kinds of dialogues have happened in a respectful way and a positive way and a way of moving forward? In international law, an international forum seems to work for certain things, but is it the right place for this?
One of the things we might want to, so we it's a very complex issue, as we know, and we can really broaden this out and come away with lots of fragmented ideas. So let's see if we can bring ourselves back to the Palestinian question and maybe in a half an hour see if there's we can come up with discussions about things that we can do other than or besides having a nice conversation. I'm not telling you where to go with this, but we can really go all over the map and end up nowhere. Yeah.
Anyone else resident here? It's such a confusing issue that I would like to get, I want to be optimistic, but I'd like to get a baseline as what is the worst case scenario? It seems like every year it gets worse and worse and worse. What's the worst that can happen?
Is the worst, I'll ask you, the worst political thing that Israel will unilaterally draw a boundary and say, that's it?
Nuclear war.
Yeah. Followed by nuclear war with Iran, or nuclear strike on Iran, or...
From the perspective of Palestinians, the worst would be that they would be given, quote, a state that would... be very tiny amounts of land and not contiguous. So it would be like the Bantustans were supposed to be in South Africa. Pockets of population. Israel would get rid of the population, the numbers, because Israel has a demographic problem if they incorporate the Palestinian territories. They've got a majority then Palestinian, not Jewish. But if they can get rid of as many people as possible, but on as little land as possible, in isolated little islands, and call that the Palestinian state and that the world would accept it, that's the worst possible scenario.
But the Palestinians would erupt. I mean, that's just pushing it under the towers.
But they're caged. They're fenced and they're walled.
Yeah.
The wall is 26 feet tall, snaking through East Jerusalem, cutting off Jerusalem, which is the economic heart for the Palestinians, and the West Bank. And it snakes around Bethlehem and in other areas it's fences. And it's not a simple fence system. It is as wide as a football field is long. And it has tracer paths and security cameras and
we paid for it.
It's all bought and paid for by U.S. tax dollars.
So what are we trying to avert?
Well, I think what would happen is they would be penned up in this outdoor prison, like Gaza is already, okay? Israeli withdrawal created an outdoor prison of Gaza. And they would continue to be a cancer, a carcelet, a reason for the whole Muslim world to never come clean the way they need to come clean. And the way we need to come clean, we would never come clean. It would be an alliance of Israel, the U.S., and the West. Maybe more of the West than we think, because it's so hard to live with us unless you do what we want. So European countries are buckling to us now. And then it becomes a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. And how is this related to the Palestinians? Because the Middle East, an unsolved Israel-Palestine conflict can be the rotten core of a regional and a global conflict that can very quickly become a religious conflict. And I'm sorry, Paul, but it's an example of how complicated and how interrelated all this
is.
That your comment was absolutely on target, I think.
Yep.
Remember the cartoon crisis? The cartoon, the Danish cartoons, wasn't a big deal here. Thank God, you guys. But Europe just didn't know what to do. And what really, I think that showed us in just a flash. It's like an apocalypse. Bring back the curtain, as Barbara said the first morning, and reveal something. Denmark, who is just like us, freedom of expression, personal freedom. Creativity, as few laws as possible. The less laws, the better life is. And you can do that with a little country of 5 million people where we're all the same, and you know it's got a lot of alcoholism and drug use and prostitution, but it, you know they can handle that, and they have freedom of expression. You know, the Danes think everything's permitted unless it's forbidden. And the Swedes think everything's forbidden unless it's permitted. And they go their merry way as a homogeneous...
But the magazine was a minor magazine. Go ahead.
Okay. But my point is, yeah, it's a minor magazine and drawings aren't that bad.
No.
But you had a classic ships in the night because the editors, the Danish leaders, couldn't even hear the protests of the Danish Muslims who said, this is sacrilege of the Prophet Muhammad. and they protested politely to the newspaper. They tried to see the prime minister. They talked to the Congress, the parliament. They didn't get a hearing. Then they took it to Egypt, and they showed these things in Egypt. And Egypt took it to the Organization of the Islamic Conference in Jeddah, and it got passed around among the ministers of the different countries. And then people started seeing possibilities in it, because you could see this was dynamite. But what happened was you had a Middle East, and my old boss there, an Arab Muslim, an Arab Orthodox Christian, used to always tell people, we never had the Enlightenment. We never let science kill God, and let religion become something off all by itself, and let the freedom of expression and the individual and all these things. Those are all, we've broken all these things up, and that's why we have so much trouble living our faith, isn't it? Because we're all off in a little corner as Westerners in this, you know, rationalist world we live in, where science really is in the driver's seat, even in church, in a sense. And we, you know, we don't know that much about faith compared to world history. The Middle East never had that. He said they never killed God. And so for them, this was, you had two people, and actually the Danes, they were interesting because they were worshiping, in my opinion, they were worshiping freedom of expression. That's their God. Freedom is their God. And the fact that freedom can never be divorced from responsibility had sort of slipped them by. And the fact that we live in a global community where there are people, whether you like it or not, who are going to see that drawing of Muhammad as a terrorist with a bomb on his head. It could only be this big, or whatever it was, the ones I saw on the internet. That the fact that that can't be accepted, which we can find to be completely unacceptable, that they can't accept that. But what the Danes didn't understand is that it can't be accepted. It's just excluded. And so you have this collision of the two worlds. And what I think was so shocking was, over that little tiny thing of cartoons, several people lost their lives. Swedish, Danish, and some other embassies were burned down. Denmark lost business throughout the Muslim world. Any number of things started to happen. And I think we have there a kind of example of a demonstration of what the Palestinians are now caught in even deeper than they were before, which is this misconnection between the West and the Middle East, which I tried to outline in a bit of the history the other day. But how can we take the cartoons, because it's like coming to terms with the Palestinian issue. What do we have to change in order to get along with this huge chunk of humanity that has a different experience than us? And what do they have to change? And it's not all on us. But I think acting as if our world really is the world, it's just a question of those others catching up with us.
Or we're doing it the right way.
Yeah.
There are more than one right way.
The line I always hear is, if we aren't doing it right, how come all those other people want to be like us? That's what I hear a lot.
But not everybody wants to be like us.
But a lot of people do. And I think these are all blinders on what we're facing.
Okay. One of the things that we have to change, I think, is our own sense that we can stand a little more understanding of ourselves. We really believe in our information system and really think of ourselves as more advanced. There have been some good studies of anthropology about the use of the word tribal, for example. And there is no real base. Lutheran jokes is an expression of tribalism, the kind of jokes that we make about ourselves. There. The way Arabs govern themselves in the United States, in the Middle East, is heavily dominated by the United States and creates seething anger at the grassroots of Saudi Arabia for the way in which these royal families are bought off by U.S. oil interests. We just absorb that as somehow characteristic of who they are as limited or less advanced than us, never mind the fact that our democracy is considerably wanting, starting at the level of how many people don't vote, and moving from there to the power of television advertising. So I want to ask, how do we inform ourselves better? And what are good, what are some more reliable sources than we're likely to get delivered to our doorstep?
Should we have a jamboree and I'll put up whatever people have found as reliable?
We did that for the,
Great, right. Thank you.
Who's got a reliable source?
Jennifer's one.
Well, now, if you want, on Israel-Palestine, the Israeli daily newspaper, Haaretz, is in English, and it's available on the website. I'd recommend two journalists regarding Palestine, and that would be Amir Haas and Daniel Levy. You can just Google them.
And they're both Israeli.
Actually, they're both Israelis, yes. That's one source. I'll just toss that one out for now.
Daniel who?
Levy, L-E-V-Y.
You should see what Amir Haas writes about Israel in Haaretz. It's fantastic. And about Palestine. Anyway, other sources.
Come on, Jennifer. ELCA.org.
/ Middle East.
Very active website, a lot of resources. And the ELCA program is called Peace Not Walls. I think you can.
That's actually on the website. An excellent one that's actually recommended by a former U.S. State Department diplomat who now does advising to the PLO. He recommends the American Task Force on Palestine, and they do have a daily news thing. They use LexisNexis in order to capture coverage related to Palestine and Israel. There are quite a few others.
Your local one.
Well, I'm part of an organization that has representatives, people who are active, that are Christian, Muslims, and Jews, and other faiths and no faiths. It's a secular organization. It's Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights. It's AUPHR.org. And if you go on our website, we're based in Portland, Oregon, and if you go on our website and do a join us, you can get, well, see, you probably want to do that because that'll give you, every other week you'll get an alert about what's going on locally. We do have a news listserv. You could email and say, add us to the news listserv. But you would get a fair amount of things on the Oregonian also. So I would recommend probably going to the American Task Force. There's also the Electronic Intifada.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
That'll keep you awake.
Yeah. there's others. I have a whole list. We'll be publishing We've conducted studies on our local newspaper, The Oregonian, the news section and the opinion section, and met with the editors of both sections. And we'll be publishing the two reports into one publication, and we're titling it Dangerous Omissions, How the U.S. News Media Perpetuates the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict, a case study. So you could see it. And in the back of that will be a whole list of recommendations of different resources. But frankly, this is enough. You don't need more. This is plenty.
How many people would like this and don't have pencils? Okay, well, you've got a record. If you give it to me, I'll type it up and we'll just have them available in the dining hall tomorrow.
That'd be great.
Yeah. Go ahead and keep writing them. Oh, that's great. Okay, thank you.
In this connection of information, I spent a few days with my brother, the one who had been there for the 6 years, just a couple of weeks ago. Spent some time with him. He's been back to the area several times. And if he were here, I think his frustration would be not even as much with the conflicting forces over there, but why doesn't the mainline American media present the factual stuff, very much like the kinds of things that Jonathan presented 2 days ago, which were just straight historical kinds of documentation and the maps. And my brother, when we had this, he went out, and he's not an emotive type person, but he just kept thinking, why doesn't this get covered? And then we talk about something else, and why isn't this told? And why is it not on NBC and CBS and ABC?
Why not?
And just that his anger is more, actually was as much at them now at this point as at the factions, because people, when they get in conflict, they do dumb things to each other, so it's not good. But it's understandable. But why our media, which tries to push through the issues on both sides, why it's not there? So I suppose he, if he were here, and speaking through him, one of the things that he would wish we as a Lutheran and the American community generally would be to put enough pressure on the media to somehow, let's get facts out so that people can even begin to make their own rather than just getting one side.
Let's be confident here that we're not saying tonight our conclusion is we have to change the American mainstream media, you know, as a little task for the coming 100 years. Let's use the internet to inform ourselves with alternative views and then get on with what needs to be done. Could I say, I'm violating a rule here by talking for the third time, but you know what the Swiss government concluded? They concluded that Christians in America are the key to peace in Israel-Palestine. And so they approached the church in Switzerland, and they want to even give money to the church in Switzerland to bring over Christians from America, especially the kind that support Israel so with such blinders and so with such destructive impact, to engage them.
Yeah.
And they kind of look to the church to be able to do that. And I think that there's plenty of reasons, if you look what's in the Bible, for a good discussion with our sisters and brothers who are Christian, bringing to them some of this. I mean, there's a place to apply it right at home. You don't have to go over there and do diplomacy in the Middle East. You can start right here, because the U.S. policy is, as I've said in my thing, is implicating us in a way which is reflecting very, very negatively on our whole faith. And if you think that a Muslim or even just a secular Middle Easterner is going to distinguish between an evangelical and a mainline Christian, well, we got good policy on the Middle East. Forget it. You know what they had to do when the World Council of Churches voted to tell people to other member churches to look at what the Presbyterians had done with divestment about the occupation? It was reported in the Middle East in various newspapers, and they had to rehabilitate the word Christian in order to explain who had taken this action. They had to explain the word Christian because the word they usually use for Protestants is completely identified with the CIA and with the American Zionist policy. And as a Protestant World Council of Churches, essentially Protestant, ecumenical, they had to explain, they had to use the same word that is tainted, but say, "You don't. This doesn't mean what you think it means. These people are actually speaking some sense about what needs to happen." So again, the cultural gap, you know, the worldview thing, and I think that if they are in part reacting to our commercial, valueless, market is God, a penetration of their society, we have to be able to go somewhere else than to the very media, who are in a sense degrading our life too. Why don't they ever say this, Norm? They don't have space, and people don't want to read it. If you're based on what people want to read, it's like the Vespers tonight. You know, was what I said real? Was it happy? Was it fun? It was real, but it wasn't happy or fun. And I think our media, to make money, have just pushed us relentlessly in the direction of happiness, entertainment, and fun. And, you know, to try to make a connection to our topic, as a democracy and as a superpower, I think we're becoming incapable of a sane foreign policy, because we don't have an information system to produce an educated public.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have it, but we don't use it. I mean, you're talking about things that are available to all of us.
But, and here's where lifestyle comes in, yeah. You know? Our lifestyle is to not make the effort.
Right.
Our lifestyle is to work all the time and not have time to make the effort. Our lifestyle is to have things in sound bites. Now, I'm really running away here in a wild direction, but you feel it when you're overseas. You feel how enormously out of joint something is. You said the trolley's off the tracks, the wheel's off the trolley, however. You really feel that. And it's being expressed by extremists in violence, it's being expressed in most people's, the majority's minds, by voting no if they're asked in a poll what they think about America. You know, our popularity is way, way down. When we have so many things to claim, so many things to share with the rest of the world.
Sometimes it's not just about busyness, it's about the affluenza. It's about...
I'd wrap all that together. I really
you know,
would.
But it's not just my busyness, it's much more comfortable not knowing.
I think our
ignorance is bliss and there's too many happy people running around.
I think our country's hit a peak and we're on a downward slide. Not economically, but morally, spiritually, concern for fellow man. And we got all this and the, kind of the hell of the other, except for oil. What are we going to do about oil? If we had all the oil in the world, I think this country would just go right on the way we are. And you and I are talking to the choir. Most people don't give a shit about it. They just what's in their little world. You know. And there's so much, well, just this Iraqi war, the injustice in our country, where there's a certain small 1% of the country is involved in the war, that have people there, you see. Most people just hear the news, and too bad, you know, I can go on their life, get another car, gee, I got a 4,000 square foot house. I actually don't give a lot of hope for this country long term. And all the religions are going down. Catholic churches, half the people, I'm Catholic, half the people I know, they just take what they want out of the church, you know. If they like to go and hear a good preacher, they go. They don't go to the parish, support the parish that's doing the nuts and bolts. I've told my wife for about 10 years, I think we're on the way down the tube. And country, I don't know what happened there, but China's coming right here, and they're just going to blow us away.
India, too.
In India.
Question behind.
There isn't the fight,
and
the feeling for this country there was in my when I was younger. Mm-hmm. Is the Lutheran Church population...
We're a dinosaur in a fish tank of minnows. And they're all hooked up with us because of the globalization of business and because of the success of our business model. And their own, I really believe, Europe is more like us now than it's ever been. Europe is going down the track of market capitalism. And again, I want to bring that back in because I think this is an enormous challenge for us as Christians to be identified with a system that is, as Barbara's telling us every morning, ruining the planet and is... Turning our foreign relations into a kind of a handmaiden of our domination. Listen to what Lowell's saying in his classes.
Can I jump in and say, I think I would put the change further back to 9/11, though. I think one thing that significantly happened, I mean, when did the U.S. become an outlaw? Sunday is going to be Hiroshima Day, of course, so one could... And then look at events like that in the 80s. But on the Middle East specifically, I think one can date the change in some ways to the shift that happened in the Republican Party. And it was a gradual shift, but for quite a while, Republicans were, if you want to say, better than Democrats on this Palestine issue because, well, a variety of factors. But for example, this current President Bush's father was actually one of the best presidents in terms of being a friend to Palestinians, and certainly his Secretary of State, James Baker. But in the meantime, and a number of Republicans took punishment for supporting a kind of pro-Palestinian position, perhaps most notably Senator Charles Percy in Illinois was defeated by a Lutheran, Senator Paul Simon, who's been up here at Holden, who I like very much, but he was able to capitalize on the fact that Percy had been to Amman, Jordan. So for a long time, Republicans were better and more even-handed on the Palestinian issue. But the Christian right takeover of the Republican Party with the strong contingent of Christian Zionism, that is this new movement that includes people like Tim LaHaye, Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, Jack Van Impe, John Hagee in San Antonio, they've taken the Republican base in a very, very... militantly pro-Israel direction with Christian Zionism. So I think just in the 8 or 10 years since George Bush Jr. has been president, that's been a significant shift that wouldn't be dated just to 9/11.
We've had an outlaw in Palestine for a long time, but an outlaw globally on international law, on treaties. You know, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty is the most significant disarmament treaty in world history. And we're just tearing it to pieces, letting it crumble. And what's going to come up in its place? So I agree that the strands go back a long way. I put it somewhere in the Clinton time. You know, Clinton made some, he signed some things and then they weren't ratified. You know, so between Clinton and Gingrich, I think we started tipping beyond the point on the general attitude towards international obligation. The Law of the Sea Treaty we didn't sign, you know? That was an early indicator. Kyoto is what we obviously want.
I think Mark and then Norma, what I'm seeing is you had your hand up.
Well, you said the first day of your class, and I appreciated it, that what we say we have to be able to say in front of Jewish and Muslim colleagues and friends, and I think regrettably many Americans don't have any Jewish and Muslim colleagues and friends. They couldn't identify them unless they saw them on television. 3% of white Americans have been in the home of an African-American family. 3%.
3%?
3%.
Yeah.
It's about the same for white Americans in Jewish American households.
Wow.
So, now I happen to live in a town that's about 85% Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
Our seminary shares a campus with a major Jewish institution. And the one thing I'd say to your comment earlier, I really appreciate what you said, there are many Jews who would have much more information and much deeper feeling than the Jewish representative who came to talk to you. I work with people for whom, Jewish people, for whom the choice, and I live with them, the choice is not Palestine or Israel. It's got to be somehow both. And they're not just looking for little islands to capture Palestinians on. There are many Jews who are in as much anguish over these issues, American Jews, as we are. And some of them live in our neighborhood. So what can we do? I think one thing is we can begin to talk to people we know, our colleagues, our friends, our neighbors, who are Jewish and who are Muslim, about these issues. Ask them what they think. Ask them for their memories. This topophilia is a wonderful term. In the Middle East, it's complicated because the same topos is phileen from multiple people. And I think there's another way of thinking, another way, just to add to that, and that's topopatheia, or some suffering, the suffering of place. That I don't think it's fair to say that we created Israel just so we didn't have to have them in our nation. Excuse me.
Oh, no, that's just what the speaker said.
I understand. But I think that's often a perception. And in point of fact, Jews of moderate and liberal perspectives are very often very deeply conflicted about these issues.
I can appreciate that. I was just trying to relate what the experience was I had at that.
And I'm simply saying I think we need to name that as a one view which doesn't represent many conscientious Jewish Americans, to say nothing of Israeli Jews.
Well, I think there is, in a sense, though, just because that person was chosen to speak to our group, that maybe, though, like all of us in any congregation, we need to not let the far right or the far left rob the center.
Or the uninformed right.
Came and spoke to us, so that then, I mean, that's just like we have, if somebody calls me a Christian and they're thinking of Jerry Falwell, because that's the same issue as we haven't ever really distinguished ourselves between the far, we do, but other people, far right or middle or left or whatever. So that was just the experience we had at the church.
Just amazing, just as a historian, last point, that pain and suffering has a very long shelf life in an ethnic community or tribal community or a racial community or a national community, a very long shelf life. And for some of us who don't even know these memories, on either side, we can somehow think that, why don't they just work it out? Let's look at a map. Let's find a solution. But that memory of pain is so, so difficult.
There is a difficulty in that many, many Jewish Americans are uninformed. Mm-hmm. They the Jewish Federations and the American Jewish Committee present a conservative right and military support of Israel. Jewish Voice for Peace, I don't know if that got up, that's an American organization. They're an excellent resource. Brit Sedek, that's Jewish Alliance for Peace and Justice. They just had an advocacy days like the Lutherans and ecumenical people do. They just did that in Washington, D.C., and did lobbying, and locally I'm in touch with a fellow who went and did that, and then, you know, he didn't know it, but the very morning that he and three other from Oregon Jewish people had gone to this training, did the lobbying in Congress, another gal who's Lutheran had happened to call that afternoon. The change in tone from that phone receptionist in taking the phone call was a watershed change. And all of a sudden, our congressional district person actually were seeming to hear that for once, even though we've tried, you know, we've done lobbying and stuff, but we've not had receptivity. But the Jewish voices going and speaking and giving another perspective, another view. There's a long history of, I don't know how many of you read this or heard about the study that the Harvard and the other...
Chicago
professor did. It's gotten shorthand named the Israel Lobby. And these two professors are noted for looking at, you know, what meets strategic needs, basically, of our country, military, et cetera. And they critiqued our virtually unconditional support of Israel's not being in meeting our strategic needs. They've actually spoken with military people in the U.S. who seem to be more receptive to what they're, you know, telling them than the general population. But my friend Joel told me that, because he came to our meetings, and but then he said, you know, he only has so much time, and he's a teacher. He says, I'm going to work with Brissetti, but then he and I stay in communication. He says, because I'm finding, since they haven't been on the other side of the wall, and he had, because he traveled with Global Exchange, and he said, they really don't, I mean, the people here, so I need to help them to really even have a greater picture about the realities over there. And most interreligious trips that go over there, if there's Jewish-Christian trips, if you look closely at the itinerary, you will see that it's almost totally within Israel. Very, if at all, on the other side of the wall. And here's another resource for Israeli human rights organizations. B'Tselem is the key.
All
website.
The organizations listed on the left are Israeli Jewish organizations.
Oh, you wrote B'Tselem.
American.
There's
Israel.
No E there, though, Barbara.
There isn't.
Oh, it's just book. The website.
Is there anybody that hasn't B'Tselem. Had a chance to speak? I'm looking at my watch, and I'm watching some people depart. Yeah. Would like to? Any other folks to?
Well, I just want to raise a question. I don't want to give a speech, but I think if something's really going to happen, I think something's got to happen through the White House and Congress, and therefore there's got to be enough pressure on them. And so I ask anybody here, is it realistic at all to expect that there would be leadership coming from the Jewish community and from the religious right to speak up with enough confidence that people in Congress could urge the administrative branch to take a true... trying to be neutral, negotiating position without fear of being hit the next election. I think it's got, in my opinion, it's got to come from that side. We mainline Protestants and the rest can speak out, but knowing that it's all the more difficult with not only the Jewish community, but also the Christian right, that's a lot of votes, and unless Congress or the other believe that somehow they can do this without losing. So again, the question is, anybody think there's a chance that there can be leadership in the Jewish community or in the religious right to step forward to let the congressional people know it's okay to vote neutral?
They just formed an organization in Texas. What's that one called that they just formed, the Christian right that with support of the Jewish organization?
Yeah, it's a bad. John Hagee is the head of it. Yeah, it was on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, Americans, Christians for the Support of Israel or something. Well, just to answer that question, I mean, maybe not, probably not, but we mustn't ever lose hope. One of the things the ELCA, the Lutheran Office for Governmental Affairs, most strongly suggests is get your bishop to go to the Middle East and get them to try to take along your congressional representative.
Yeah.
An example would be Representative Lois Capps of California,
yeah,
a Lutheran who went and was transformed by that. I mean, pretty much anybody who goes is transformed. But so there's a big push on now to get all 65 ELCA bishops and to get them to bring a congressional representative. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that would be, you know, it's one by one, but that's how you make change.
So I think really to ask the Jewish people to take on a role that's different than what many Americans take on. I mean, the idea of Israel, right or wrong, you know, for many people, that's the position. And, you know, I know that there are people who don't believe that. It's a very difficult emotional and religious position to take, to be a Jew and to say, I oppose what Israel is doing right now. It's very difficult.
But all of those organizations on the left are doing that.
Right.
But you're right.
And they should be supported. But to expect that the leadership is going to come from within the Jewish people in this country, I think, was just totally unrealistic.
Well,
I think it's unrealistic.
Well, without that, then I wonder who's going to have the guts in Congress to go against, knowing that this could cost them a bunch of seats or a few Senate seats. That's what's tricky.
Yeah, and it may be that, you know, liberal or moderate Christians need to add this to their list of issues that they need to speak up about. And it shouldn't be low on the list, you know, as we're talking about right now. It should be much higher on the list. And find the centrist element of it, which is looking, I think, for, you know, a longer-term sustainable solution there. But I just don't see that leadership coming from any group that has much political standing that I know of.
It's you haven't had a chance to talk in the election. This will close after this, and then I will get these typed up, and we'll hand them up somewhere up on the radiators up in on the east end of the dining room.
I guess what I'd add, and maybe this is a place to end on, because I want to come back to something Norm said at the beginning, which has to do with this notion of topophilia. And maybe one of the things that we as Christians can bring to this is some sympathy and empathy and compassion for this incredible sense of the power and the importance of a place like Jerusalem. I mean, here we are tonight singing these lines. How can we sing a holy song in a strange home? Where does this come from? Where does this come from? I mean, this is right out of Jewish history. So we can have some feeling, and I've not been there, but I can imagine what it's like. And those of you who've been to Jerusalem, who've been to Bethlehem, who've been to Galilee, I mean, these very words are so potent for us as Christians. So we can have some, we can resonate to an extent with that. At the same time, we can remember that even in the Old Testament prophets, and certainly in that Jewish prophet Jesus, there was this strong sense that God is not located in a particular place. God is not in the temple. We hear this in the prophets. So we can at the same time hopefully bring that prophetic voice, and we need to find prophetic voices in the Middle East who can both affirm, I think, the power of the land and yet also recognize that we do not need to locate God there.
Thank you, everybody, and have a good night, and we'll run into you tomorrow.